From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In May, the White House greatly expanded the number of streams and wetlands protected by the EPA to include smaller tributaries that feed into bigger waterways. The House voted to block the new rule, and now the Senate is making similar moves. They say it's a federal power grab, a violation of property rights. But the Washington face-off on environmental laws goes way beyond clean water this summer. To air, energy, endangered species, public lands. This hour on Point, the summer's big looming battles over the environment. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you tracking how much is on the line with environmental protection moves this summer? What are you pushing for or against? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington, Coral Davenport, energy and environmental reporter for the New York Times. Coral Davenport, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
We've got a big landscape of initiatives to look across here, but let's just set the stage a little bit first. Barack Obama has been frustrated on any number of fronts during his presidency, but the environment is a front on which he appears to be looking to really claim a legacy here.
That's absolutely right, Tom. In his first term, President Obama tried to pass a huge, sweeping climate change bill through Congress, a cap-and-trade bill. That bill failed. In his second term, it became very clear the Republican majority Congress is not going to enact any of these significant environmental initiatives. But the president has in his pocket these two very powerful laws passed in the 1970s, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. These are sort of like the grandparents of environmental law, not just in the U.S., but in the world. And what he has done is go back and look at the authority, the existing authority he has under these old but very powerful laws. And he's putting forth really big, sweeping, aggressive, historic regulations using the power of these old laws. He doesn't need Congress to do it. These laws are incredibly powerful. These new regulations will, of course, be challenged in the courts, and it will be a question if they hold up. But for now, the kinds of measures that the president is putting forward using existing authority really are sort of legacy makers, just huge new environmental protection. Huge new regulations on polluting industry, initiatives that could change the landscape of especially the U.S. energy and environment landscape.
Could we dive in on water first? Because this is such an interesting one. And as you say, Clean Water Act is the tool here. The EPA and the Obama administration looking to expand the EPA's oversight. Describe what it has been and what it will be if these new regulations, this new purview stands, Coral.
So the Clean Water Act is an interesting case. Passed in the 1970s, it created federal authority to regulate major waters, things like the Chesapeake Bay, Mississippi River, Puget Sound, came under federal protection for clean water. Under the original law, it also protected rivers and streams, so-called headwaters that flowed into those larger bodies of water. However, in the 90s and early 2000s, there were some Supreme Court cases that kind of created confusion over what could be regulated and what wasn't regulated under the law. EPA stopped regulating, stopped enforcing regulation of a lot of those smaller bodies of water, the streams, the headwaters, the wetlands. And so this new regulation goes back. It clarifies the federal government's authority. It re-expands the federal government's legal authority to regulate all those streams, headwaters, tributaries, wetlands, anything that any body of water that feeds into a larger body of water. Essentially, it puts under federal protection about 60% of the waters of the U.S. This has created huge pushback. one group in particular that is leading the fight against this new Waters of the U.S. Regulation are farmers. Farmers say that now, you know, streams, tributaries, ditches that are on their property will be subject to federal regulation. They'll have to apply for permits to engage in any kind of agricultural activity, tilling of soil, anything that could create you know, fertilizer running into that water. They'll have to apply for permits. If they are doing any kind of tilling around those bodies of water, they may have to stop. They could be fined by the EPA. Other groups, real estate developers, golf course owners are upset about this. A lot of groups say, look at this and say, well, this is a huge, you know, this is an expansion of federal regulation. This is going to hurt economic activity. This is going to create a huge burden on landowners, particularly landowners who make their living on the land, like farmers.
We've got the sound of a couple of those right here. One first from Missouri. David Luker raises cattle on his property worried about the waters regulations the EPA is coming out with. He'd have to have permits, he said, to control erosion on the bed of a creek that runs through his property. That creek would be subject under the Waters of the United States rule. He talked with NPR's All Things Considered just a few days ago.
Anyone that owns any land in this country that has any type of little creek or puddle or anything in it, in order for you to do anything on your property, you're going to have to go to someone and ask permission, and then they're going to tell you how you have to do it, and they don't care what it costs.
Okay, the Obama administration says you call this historic and aggressive. They say we're just living up to the intent of the 1970s legislation in the first place. What's the specific goal here, Coral? Do we have a water safety problem in this country?
Well, during the years the Clean Water Act was sort of unclear. What happened was the EPA stopped regulating, stopped enforcing regulation in a lot of these smaller bodies of water. And there were many more instances of water pollution. Levels of water pollution did go up. And that is one of the reasons that the administration decided to go back and do this and say, during that period of time, the administration, the federal government, could control the pollution and the economic activity around larger bodies of water. But their point is, look, all these smaller bodies of water flow into that larger body of water. If you want to keep this water clean, these big bodies of water clean, you have to go back to the smaller waters that flow into them. And instances of pollution in those smaller waters were going up.
Let's look at clean air, climate change. There's a big push on coal-fired power plants this summer. What's going on there?
So this is going to be, if it stands up legally, probably President Obama's signature environmental policy, and probably, he hopes, a kind of a cornerstone of his legacy. So we just talked about the Clean Water Act, which was passed in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Its sort of sibling was the Clean Air Act, passed in 1970. Under existing authority of the Clean Air Act, President Obama's EPA this summer is going to put forth final regulations that would cut carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants across the country, both existing coal-fired plants, and it would create limits on emissions from future power plants, which would probably just freeze construction of new power plants. It will probably, or new coal plants, mm-hmm. Freeze construction of new coal plants and probably lead to the closure of hundreds of existing coal plants. That's a really big deal for the environment. Coal-fired power plants are the top contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., and it's a huge deal for the economy as well. They're a major source of electricity, and the administration's hope is that this will trigger a fundamental transformation of the nation's energy economy from fossil fuels to renewables.
The G7, of course, meeting this week in Europe, and President Obama, along with the other leaders there, committing to phasing out fossil fuel use by 2100. Seems far away, but when you talk about such a big deal, this would be a step in that direction. Then we get to natural resources, national monuments being made of federal lands, and the protection of endangered species, the greater sage grouse. What about those, Coral?
Yes, those are all on the docket as well. And this is sort of On things like the climate change regulation, that's in many ways unprecedented. I think a lot of people were surprised that the president went in that direction. In terms of creating monuments and putting land off limits to development, that's sort of classic legacy building. We will see this president do what his predecessors did, what George Bush did in final years before leaving office. President Clinton, before leaving office, did a ton of these. This is another old law, the Antiquities Act, which is almost 100 years old.
1906.
Yes. That gives the president the authority to declare something a national monument. And he could declare a statue a national monument, but he could also declare something that's hundreds or thousands or millions of acres of land.
George W. Bush did this with ocean waters around Hawaii.
Yes, he did. And so we absolutely expect to see the president use this authority, especially in the West, and start to declare big chunks of land as national monuments, thus putting them off limits for future development. I've heard people within the administration say this president would like to designate more land as national monument, protect more land using this law than any of his predecessors. So I would expect to see a lot of these sort of big, dramatic, very large protected areas emerging as the president hits the home stretch of the administration.
And then we've got the greater sage grouse, an endangered species, also a Western issue. How much land would that put off limits for development? If
potentially a lot. I had someone tell me that the question of the greater sage grouse is going to be like the next snowy owl if it goes on the endangered species list.
I'm looking at their priority areas for conservation of the greater sage grouse in the West on a map here where they're outlined in kind of a red. It looks like chickenpox across the West, and not a slight case of chickenpox. But without some protection, there could be a species in trouble. The law says we don't do that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the summer's big environmental battles shaping up in Washington over clean water and air and energy and public lands and the greater sage grouse endangered species. Coral Davenport, energy and environment reporter for the New York Times, is with us. Environmental issues, global climate issues have been a big deal at the G7 meeting over the last few days in Germany. Here's German Chancellor Angela Merkel talking through an interpreter about how the leaders there have agreed that their nations would phase out the use of fossil fuels, full stop, by the year 2100.
We have committed to the fact that in the course of this century, we want to see we need a decarbonization of the world economy.
That requires moves now. Here's President Obama speaking yesterday in Germany.
We continue to make progress toward a strong global climate agreement this year in Paris. All the G7 countries have now put forward our post-2020 targets for reducing carbon emissions, and we'll continue to urge other significant emitters to do so as well. We'll continue to meet our climate finance commitments to help developing countries transition to low carbon growth.
Is there pushback on the environmental agenda for the summer in the USA? You better believe there is. Here was Republican Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming last Wednesday on the Senate floor saying that the EPA's Waters of the United States rule takes freedom away from Americans.
The Environmental Protection Agency released the final version of a new rule that will dramatically increase the agency's power and will devastate Americans' ability to use their own property and their own water. With this rule, President Obama's Environmental Protection Agency overreaches and ignores the American public.
That's just on the waterfront. There's the Wyoming senator. And out in his territory, here's the sound of the greater sage grouse strutting near Hudson, Wyoming. We've been looking at all of this with Coral Davenport of the New York Times. She covers it in very well for the Times. I want to bring in a couple more voices, if I may. With us from Washington, Daniel Bausan, Managing Director of Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress, progressive think tank there. Daniel, welcome and thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Washington, Nick Loris is here. He is a fellow at the Heritage Foundation, conservative think tank there. Economist, focuses on energy, environmental, and regulatory issues. Nick Loris, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Danielle, look across this big agenda of pushes that we're in the midst of this summer. How important, how historic, the word Coral Davenport uses, are these?
Well, I think it's important to remember that a lot of these moves aren't unprecedented. We have regulated pollution from power plants since 1970. We have been regulating water since 1970. And as Coral mentioned earlier, this isn't necessarily, I don't think this should be considered an expansion of authority, but rather clarifying authority. This is closing a loophole for the Clean Waters of the U.S. rule. It's closing a loophole that failed to protect safe drinking water standards for 1 in 3 Americans. So although these are extremely important changes in regulations that we're seeing, they are not a huge expansion of existing authority. They just are in compliance with existing authority.
I mean, so you say, but how do you explain the huge pushback if it's steady as she goes?
Well, I think if you follow the history of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, it starts to look a little bit like a Groundhog Day scenario. In 1970, you saw an incredible pushback against regulations when the Clean Air Act was passed, and in 1977 when it was amended, and in 1990 when acid rain regulations were implemented. So there have always been lawsuits and there has been pushback, and I think that that will continue to happen. But the fact is that we need to protect our air and our water and our land, and that's what these regulations are setting out to do.
Nick Loris, you follow the environment and the economy. We haven't even mentioned a couple of things here. Reining in emissions from big trucks, freight trucks on the highways, reining in emissions of commercial airliners, passenger liners, and more. When you look at this raft of measures being pushed this summer, what would you embrace, Nick? What would you be cautious or more about?
I would embrace a return to the states handling environmental issues and oppose this dramatic shift towards more federal control over America's land and America's waters. And what we've seen with the Clean Power Plan, with the waters of the United States, with the regulations you just mentioned, is this huge overreach that takes decisions away from the states. It takes decisions away from the people who know best how to protect their environment, but also promote economic well-being, things like using ATVs, energy development, whatever the case may be. And what we're seeing with this administration, and in fact what we've seen with past administrations as well, is more federal government control, more federal ownership of lands out in the West. And that, in a lot of instances, has led to environmental degradation because there's so much for the federal government to take control of that they do a bad job of doing it.
Of course, the EPA administrator has described things differently here. This is Gina McCarthy. She was talking about Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican, of course, from Kentucky. He's been personally appealing to state governors to challenge the EPA's Clean Power Plan. Campaign hasn't been terribly successful so far, but here's McCarthy talking with Kate Shepard of the Huffington Post in April, saying, "No, we're trying to help the states get on top of this."
I don't see this call for inaction gaining momentum. In fact, just the opposite. The states are recognizing that EPA has never really crafted a rule that was so respectful of the role of states, where the federal government just sets the standard and allows the states to develop their plans. They know we're serious about this. They know climate change is serious business and concern. And they know they're best positioned to design a plan that's going to work for them.
Danielle Bossin, we hear Nick Loris says huge overreach. We hear the EPA administrator saying never had a rule so respectful. We just set the standards and then they can do it any way they like. What do you see here, Danielle?
Well, I think that what the administrator is talking about is the fact that what the Clean Power Plan does is it tells states, here's the target, but we're going to let you decide how you're going to meet that target. And so it's offering an incredible amount of flexibility to states to do exactly what Nick is saying and to look at their own energy mix and decide how they want to meet that standard, whether it's through energy efficiency, renewable energy, efficiency in power plants. And so it is allowing the states to make those decisions. So that's what I think the administrator is saying here.
Let's hear from our listeners here. Carolyn in Austin, Texas. Carolyn, what are you following? What do you see?
Well, I see and I've listened to farmers complaining, and I think the states have had a long time since the 70s to perhaps take it upon themselves to cooperate with one another and do something about the pesticides that they've used. and their lack of progressing to manage their land in an appropriate way. And I doubt very seriously that their small dugout water areas are going to be controlled by federal government. But certainly if they have streams and they're using those streams and they're not controlling their runoffs, then everybody pays for that.
And so what about the call for states to oversee that? Do we need federal intervention there, Carolyn?
I think that perhaps the states should think about putting together a program that really shows some progress that they are willing to do and work together and make something specific about that. Otherwise, you know, it'd be the same old over the past, you know, 20 years.
Yeah, and on it would go. Carolyn, thanks for your call. Kroll Davenport, I've seen some reporting saying that many states welcome this because without it, they're just vulnerable to whatever neighboring states do or don't do. The water just runs, whether it's clean or dirty. You can get dirty water running into your state.
Right. One reason that these federal controls are in place and that we have federal laws like the Clean Air Act, like the Clean Water Act, and that we have a federal agency like the EPA is in the early part of the century, in the 50s and 60s, the regime was that states all ran their own environmental controls. And the dynamic that emerged was that states would compete to have the weakest environmental controls. States would advertise, come bring your business here because we have the lowest environmental controls, mm-hmm. the lowest regulation. And that was a dynamic that was leading to, rivers that became so polluted that they were burning, incredibly smoggy air. And so the thought was, in the creation of one federal agency, federal law for clean air, one federal law for clean water, is that the thinking was if you leave it to the states are going to compete to have the least amount of regulation. And that's why there is a need for one set of federal oversight. And that was the thinking in the creation of the Clean Water Act. Everyone's got to do the same thing. Everyone's got to regulate water, play by the same rules, no matter what state.
Nick, what keeps us from a race to the bottom if we don't have some federal oversight here, more federal oversight?
Well, I think we can have some federal oversight, but we just need that delineation of what the federal government should look over and what the state should look after. And the problem with the definition of the waters of the United States is that it was so ambiguous that we had some problems. And so I think it should be up for Congress to specifically define what states should manage, what local governments should manage, and what the federal government should manage. And to Caroline's point about, hey, I don't think the EPA is that nonsensical that it's going to administer huge fines, we can look at what happened with the Supreme Court case in Sackett versus EPA, where a family essentially wanted to place gravel on virtually dry land to build a home, and the EPA was fining them $75,000 per day just for a family. So we can think that this is so egregious that it won't happen, but it's actually happened, and it's problematic for the future.
Daniel Bossan, do you see Congress, the House has already acted on the waterfront, Senate looking at that right now, do you think they're going to get into the middle of this and try and rein in the EPA? Can they do that? Does Congress just pass a new law and the EPA is shut off from this path?
Well, I would just remind people that Congress has already delineated what federal authority exists over waters, and that's the Clean Water Act.
In the original, yes.
That's mm-hmm. correct. So they've done this, and really what's at stake here is this question of why should it be okay for polluters to affect water on other people's property or affect their drinking water? So, there may be pushback from Congress, and there's been a lot of sensationalized mischaracterizations of the rule, like it does affect a puddle. But the fact is that this rule is meant to protect people because of what toxins other people are dumping into that stream. When that goes onto other people's property or when that goes into the public drinking water supply, there has to be a repercussion for that. We have to protect people from this.
Let's go to Chris in New Orleans, Louisiana. Chris, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just wondering, I guess Coral said that as the streams come together, they make a big stream. The Mississippi River is the biggest, I guess.
Yeah.
And it empties out here, and it creates what's called the dead zone in our fisheries. And I was wondering what this waters of the United States, what the implication of it would be for the dead zone and the fisheries where these things are, you know, affect us.
You're talking in the Gulf of Mexico, just beyond New Orleans, where that's been growing every year. Danielle, I think most of that has been attributed to runoff of fertilizers. Would this push by the EPA have any effect on that?
Well, I think it would require permitting. Now, look, there are exemptions for permitting, so it's not as though every single farmer and ditch, or certainly not a puddle, would have to be subject to these laws. But yes, what it would do is say, if you are creating an environment where toxins are leaching into a water supply that feeds into a larger water supply, then you have to be permitted, and you have to come up with a solution so that you're reducing that amount of toxins that creates dead zones or affects drinking water.
Chris, would it go that far, even to the fields, if the runoff from the fields was leading to a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, the idea is to stop the pollution where it starts. So, again, if your field is bordered by a stream, and that stream feeds into a larger body of water, which feeds into the Mississippi and goes all the way down, the point of this regulation is to ensure that there's no pollutant, fertilizer, anything that gets into the water, you know, where it starts, the headwaters. And so the idea eventually is, yeah, I can't tell you it would end the dead, you know, solve the problem of the dead zone entirely, but it's aimed to solve problems like that. It's aimed to keep as much pollution out of those headwaters where they start.
Nora in Dowelltown, Tennessee. Nora, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My husband and I and son own 230 acres we're incredibly blessed, I guess you'd say, to have this beautiful, pristine Class 5 stream running through. We have had a dairy for a number of years, and now our son grows farm-to-table beef, pork, and chicken. Nobody likes to be told what to do. It makes me angry, but I don't have a lot of faith in people. We have a lot of people riding four-wheelers and polluting our creek. I feel like our stream runs into another stream that eventually goes into Cumberland, into the Ohio, and then into the Mississippi. If we don't have our water cared for properly, it's not really our water is the problem. It's everybody's water.
Nora, have you looked at what this new interpretation of the Clean Water Authority would mean for you on your farm? Would it mean changes?
No, having had the dairy, we were incredibly cognizant of pollution. And I know it was very difficult, because if you get even a little pollution, you can get fined and so forth. I have not read the law. I just know from how I feel and how I see other farmers doing, a lot of times they have to make money. They want to make money. There's nothing wrong with making money, but they put that first.
Nora, I appreciate your call. Nick Loris, there's a farmer who's all for it. See, you know, one stream's connected to another. It's all connected. Maybe it's time to get more careful here. Our population grows. We need the water. We can't have it polluted. The Gulf of Mexico needs clean water, too. If it hasn't happened until now, why not have the EPA get more thoroughly involved?
Well, I think it is because of this long-standing ambiguity with what the waters of the United States was defined as. And so we should have Congress define what waters of the United States is. We should protect private
property.
Danielle
says it's not ambiguous. It's very plain, and there was pushback over the years, and it's just the EPA asserting the sweeping authority of the original legislation.
But the two Supreme Court cases have led to a lot of ambiguity as to what contributes to other bodies of water. What are the definitions of waters that should be regulated at the federal level? So I do think there's been a lot of ambiguity from when the Clean Water Act was originally established. And I think we're all in agreement that farmers and real estate developers shouldn't violate the rights of private property owners and shouldn't pollute either public or private water. But the sensible thing to do is have regulation that devolves management and actually gives the states the authority to do so without this ambiguity.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about this summer's big environmental battles shaping up in Washington over clean water and air and energy and public lands and the greater sage grouse. Danielle Bossan is with us from the Center for American Progress, Managing Director for Energy Policy there, joins us from Washington. Nick Loris is with us, fellow at the Heritage Foundation, focuses on energy and environmental and regulatory issues, and economist there. Coral Davenport, energy and environment reporter for the New York Times, covering it all, is with us as well. Lots of response online here. Catherine says, states are abstract divisions of North America, the continent. Therefore, federal regulation, best option. Worried says, how is literally regulating puddles not overreach? It certainly expands the possibility of arbitrary and capricious regulatory tyranny. Michael says, difference with Europe, European leadership sees a problem, acts. U.S. leadership sees a problem, denies. And Jenna says, it's not their water just because it runs through their land. Water belongs to all of us. Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So here in Des Moines, we have two rivers, the Raccoon River and the Des Moines River, and they run right through town. Mm-hmm. And for the past, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, our levels of nitrates have been so high that we've had to be paying fees to the federal government because the water quality here is so bad. So what Bill Stowe and the Des Moines Water Works have done, and that's our local water utility, they're actually suing 3 counties that they have, that they say, and with their research, they found that the runoff from these particular counties is so high from the farming, you mentioned the fertilizers and pesticides and insecticides, they're drawing that line. And so they're taking them to court. And, you know, of course, this is local control.
Yeah, so you talk about states' rights, but even within the state, you're saying here, Laura, you've got battles between metro and county.
Yes, yes. And it's, you know, they're someone like Mr. Loris would say, well, that's pitting farmers against, you know, city people. But we have a great farm-to-table movement here. Lots of farmers here that are smaller farmers that live here, they really are good stewards of the earth. It's these big corporate hog lots and big corporate farms with just massive amounts of, you know, insecticide being used and fertilizer. That is an issue. It is really an issue for us here.
Right to the water for your town, Des Moines. Laura, I appreciate your call. Danielle, again, would this move by the EPA to expand its authority be part of a resolution of a dispute like that? Would it put the federal government in the middle of this, or would this remain independent of EPA oversight?
Well, I can't speak to the specifics of this exact scenario mm-hmm. that's been described, but what I would say is that what the Waters of the U.S. does is it closes this loophole that has allowed polluters to, frankly, dump toxins into water without regard for where that water goes. And so I do want to, again, say that this doesn't affect water that doesn't go into those larger streams. So I think this whole puddle and dry ditch argument that we've been hearing, just it's just erroneous. But the fact is, if there are corporations who took advantage of that loophole when the EPA wasn't acting and were dumping toxins into waters that went into large tributaries and rivers and affected places like Des Moines, then yes, it's certainly possible that this would help alleviate those problems.
There's water. Let's look at air and greenhouse gases in particular. Of course, there too, under the Clean Air Act, the administration moving to bring regulations that would mean a lot of coal-fired plants, as Coral Davenport said, would either not be built or actually be shut down. The president's pledge to reduce American greenhouse gas emissions by 28% from 2005 levels by 2025. That takes a lot of action somewhere. Nick Loris, can we really keep those coal-fired plants going and meet the kind of targets that President Obama and other G7 leaders are saying we've got to meet to rein in climate change?
It's highly unlikely, and it also will depend on what the courts decide as to what the EPA has authority to do, because they've used the Clean Air Act so broadly here in the Clean Power Plan to create these different building blocks for states to meet the targets that they set for each state. And the problem is this is just a death by a thousand cuts when you restrict CO2 emissions and when 85% of our energy needs are met by carbon-emitting conventional fuels. You're driving up energy prices for families and businesses, and that ripples throughout the economy.
Oil prices are at great lows now. Death by a thousand cuts, many environmentalists would describe mounting levels of CO2 in the atmosphere as death by a thousand cuts for the planet.
Well, I see climate change as occurring. I see man-made as obviously having an impact. We've seen warming over the past 60 years, and anthropogenic warming has been a part of that. But this clean power plan and these regulations are a non-solution to a very unlikely problem. So no matter what you think about climate change, even if we stopped emitting all CO2 today and cut off all our coal-fired power plants, you're talking about a change in the Earth's temperature of a few tenths of a degree Celsius by the turn of the century. So no matter what you think, these regulations are all cost and no environmental or climate benefit.
Danielle Beausent, all cost, no benefit.
I would strongly disagree. I mean, this is saying people shouldn't vote because their one vote doesn't matter. We absolutely need to do everything we can to reduce the impacts of climate change. And what Nick is saying in part is correct. We are already changing our climate, and that's why it's incredibly important to have something like the Clean Power Plan so that we mitigate the worst impacts of it, which we're starting to already see in the U.S. and certainly are seeing across the world.
What do you anticipate in terms of economic impact? People are saying environmentalists are saying we need dramatic moves. The EPA responding here. What about the economic impact?
I think part of this is, well, one, it depends on the final rule, which hasn't been released yet. So to some extent, this is a little bit of a guessing game. But when we look at what has already been released, it's in large part, it's kind of up to the states in some degree. The states are the ones who get to decide how their energy mix is going to be implemented. And so this gives them the flexibility to come up with the most cost-effective ways of making sure that they have reliable and safe and clean energy.
Coral Davenport, where do you see the sort of core of power here that will end up deciding this? I mean, on the waterfront, you've got lots of businesses weighing in against the moves. Tyson Foods and Purdue Farms and Land O'Lakes. Ocean Spray Cranberries. On this front, you've got a lot of lobbying from Halliburton and BP and Shell and Chevron. On the clean air front and energy production, where is the likely center of power that will determine what finally happens here, Coral?
The Supreme Court. There have been so many lawsuits against just against this clean power plant rule, even before it's finished. Once the final rule is finished, we'll see lawsuits at the federal level. It is almost certain that we will see this elevated to the Supreme Court, in part because this is such a complex legal decision, but also because it is so broad and sweeping and consequential. And I think it will be the Supreme Court that ultimately determines whether or not this regulation stands or falls.
And is there a court calendar for that yet? Are we talking years down the road, even though
It'll probably be a few years. The precedent on this is with other major EPA regulations that have been challenged and gone before the Supreme Court, you'll see the final regulation, the administration put forth its final regulation. In this case, we expect to see that in August. Then it'll be probably a few months before the lawsuits are filed. We'll see them go through a federal court that will be appealed, that will go to the Supreme Court. Usually that time frame is about 2 years. So if the Obama administration follows through on releasing its final climate regulation clean power plan this summer, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw this go before the Supreme Court in about 2 years.
Now, the Clean Air Act is also being pulled out to look at emissions from big trucks on the roads and from airplanes. They're also looking to cut emissions there, as the Obama administration has cut emission targets for automobiles. Are those certain to go through? Is the EPA authority there clear or challenged as well, Coral?
I think that all of these will be legally challenged. The first time President Obama used the Clean Air Act to go after greenhouse gas emissions, in other words, and this is the part that's unprecedented, using the Clean Air Act as a tool of climate change policy. Mr. Obama did that in his first term with regulations on fuel efficiency from cars, on tailpipe emissions from cars. So those Those regulations have held up. So now they're kind of continuing to do this on other sectors of the economy. Then they put out regulations on power plants. Now they're proposing regulations on big trucks. We're expecting to see an announcement that will lead to regulations on emissions from airplanes. And it could go on and on and on. The Clean Air Act could be used on all kinds of sectors of the economy. There could be regulations on oil refineries. That's something that the oil refinery industry is anticipating in the coming years. There could be regulations on cement and concrete manufacturing, which is a very carbon-intensive process. So if this administration or the next administration wanted to keep going back to the drawing board of the Clean Power Plan, of the Clean Air Act, they could regulate sector by sector across the economy. And then the question, it would keep coming back to see, well, how strong is this law? Will each of these regulations be upheld by the Supreme Court or not?
Tractor trailers, the big trucks now get about 5 to 6 miles a gallon of diesel. The administration wants them to increase their mileage per gallon by 40% by 2027. U.S. aircraft responsible for about 11% of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. transportation sector, and they're looking at that area as well. Al in Bristol, Connecticut. Al, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Thank you. I was calling to say that in regards to the new laws, I haven't read them either, but I feel that if we do not address these issues, we will be paying a price years later. And by delaying this issue, we're only kicking the can down the road. I've been supporting environmental initiatives to support clean air and water and endangered species. And I've also noticed that when I'm at the gym, for example, the media doesn't really cover this topic of environmental change. We cover other issues like terrorism, which is important for us to understand.
Yeah.
But I feel that this climate change is a national and indeed international threat to all of us. And I hope that if the Obama administration projects that image into mainstream America, we'll be able to make some effective changes.
Al, we're on it today and often. What about the economic concerns that Nick Loris raises here? If this would be a drag on the economy or raise prices for consumers, how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm working on my master's in U.S. history, and as a student of history, I've noticed the patterns in which we've had these economic phases driven by different technologies. Bristol, Connecticut, originally water, and then we've had coal and oil, and I feel that this is green energy may be the next stepping stone to driving the economy in the 21st century. I understand that there are many obstacles for us to challenge, but we are a nation that has triumphed over adversity, and we have millions of people who are willing to put ideas forward, and we have the energy as well to show the world that we can be a leader in climate change.
Let's keep evolving on that front. Al, we've got it. I appreciate your call very much, and we'll stay on it. Coral, take us to those monuments being considered in the West. There's pushback there. States trying to actually take land back from the federal government or get control of it. As the Obama administration said, what it might want to take out of normal status into this super protected national monument status?
There's a number of bodies of land that are being considered, and so we don't know for sure which ones the administration will act on. But already, lawmakers from those Western states, Republican lawmakers in particular from those Western states, are getting ready to push back. They don't want to see this happen. They don't want to see this land taken off limit from economic development. They will be challenging this in Congress, definitely. And this is kind of a longstanding battle that we've seen between this administration and particularly Republicans in the West over the use of land, over the use of this executive authority. So I think we'll see that heighten even more going forward. And you also mentioned one other issue, and this is going to be a big one, which is the question of the sage grouse. We'll see news being made on that one way or another this summer. There's a legal deadline of September 30th for the administration to determine whether or not to put the sage grouse on the endangered species list. If it does, if it goes on the endangered species list, that automatically means that its habitat and this the sage grouse ranges across nearly a dozen states in the West. Its habitat will be protected. It will be barred from a lot of economic activity, including oil and gas drilling. And I think that is something that we'll see huge conflict over if we see the administration take the decision to put the animal on the – to put that bird on the endangered species list.
Daniel Bassan, you cover energy. It's not just oil and gas. I have heard on NPR that wind farms, too, interrupt the life and habitat of the sage-grouse. What about the energy implications? I mean, they've got a wide terrain here in Wyoming and Nevada and Utah and Idaho. What about the energy implications of protecting that land, Danielle?
Well, I think what we're seeing right now is that Congress is actually thwarting an effort that's been happening for years among bipartisan states with ranchers and administration officials to form a plan that can do both, that can both protect the species and manage the land properly. It's been delayed for 1 year, and now some members in Congress are shooting to delay it for 10 years. And paradoxically, what this can do, as Coral mentioned, there's a deadline. And if the Department of Interior can't show that good steps are being taken to protect this bird and to not have it listed on the endangered species list, well, then what can happen is it can make corporate uncertainty even greater, and it can complicate land matters even more going forward.
Nick, what percent of this big environmental agenda this summer do you expect will ultimately be in effect, be the law and way of the land?
Well, I think a lot of it, because it's going to be more of a challenge for Congress to step up and stop it rather than step up a bill like they could do with cap and trade legislation. And since the administration can act unilaterally, it takes a lot of members to stop these things. So some of it may be decided in the courts, but ultimately, if the ball is moving and coal plants are shuttering and prices are going up, you know, it might be too late for the courts to even have a meaningful impact.
My fellow Americans, there is the lay of the land on the environment with a very big and busy agenda unfolding during this summer. And it's great to understand it better as we move into that. Nick Loris at the Heritage Foundation, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Daniel Bassan at the Center for American Progress in Washington. Daniel, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Coral Davenport, energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. You're terrific. Thank you so much for your work and reporting, Coral.
Thank you. It's always great to be with you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.